Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Save big money on new windows now at Menards. Update your home with vinyl windows from Jeld-Wen. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on Jeld-Wen windows in store or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more window deals happening this week now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
The Roaring Twenties was a time of glamour, gossip, and a scandal that rocked Hollywood. A scandal marked by its tragic and sensational nature. It not only revealed the shady side of Hollywood, but also made people think about the necessity of movie censorship. Welcome back, friend, to Hometown History. In today's episode, we will be exploring one of the most scandalous events in Hollywood history, the Fatty Arbuckle scandal of the 1920s, and we'll see how this scandal forever changed the rules of movie censorship. Now, who was Fatty Arbuckle? Born on March 24, 1887, in Smith Center, Kansas, Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle had a tough start in life. His dad named him after a politician he didn't like much. But that didn't stop Roscoe from finding his way into the world of entertainment. Roscoe, or Fatty as he was nicknamed, started performing on stage at just 8 years old. He loved making people laugh and kept at it until his mom passed away when he was 11. After this, life only got harder than it already was for him, and his dad refused to support him anymore. So Fatty found odd jobs at hotels, trying to support himself and push through. But as luck would have it, his singing and clowning around caught the attention of a talent scout, who invited him to a talent show for beginners. Now, the idea was that the audience decided who's good and who's not. They would express their thoughts by clapping or booing, and if an act wasn't up to par, a long stick, like a shepherd's crook, pulled them off the stage. So Arbuckle performed there. He sang, danced, and goofed around. But the audience wasn't too impressed. It looked like he missed his chance. But just as he spotted the shepherd's crook creeping in, panic set in. In a moment of desperation, he somersaulted right into the orchestra pit. And surprisingly, the audience loved it. With that, in the blink of an eye, Fatty went from odd jobs to winning a talent show. The audience loved him, and this launched his career in vaudeville. He even sang in Sid Grauman's Unique Theater in San Francisco, and toured the West Coast with the Pantages Theater Group. And his performances would change his luck further. Now, he was a big guy, tipping the scales at around 300 pounds. But despite his size, he was agile and acrobatic. Max Sennett, who was a big shot in Hollywood at the time, noticed him and signed him up for Keystone Cops comedies. This was the start of his journey as a star. His movies were full of chase scenes, gags, and of course, the famous pie in the face. And then, in 1914, Paramount Pictures saw his potential and made him an offer he couldn't refuse. $1,000 a day, plus a share of the profits and artistic control. This is equivalent to around $30,000 today. With that, Fatty became a comedy sensation. It really was a rags-to-riches story for him. And he had worked his way to the riches. Unfortunately for him, success didn't shield him from health problems. A severe infection nearly cost him his leg, and he ended up battling accusations of morphine addiction. Despite all of that, he started up his own film company, Kameek, producing some of the best silent era shorts. But in 1918, he handed over control to Buster Keaton and took up Paramount's offer to make up to 18 feature films over 3 years. And with that, he had a whopping $3 million contract with Paramount. And that would be more than $60 million in today's money. Now he was successful and evidently rich. But there were things he wasn't fond of. Despite his on-screen name, Fatty Arbuckle wasn't too fond of being called Fatty off-screen. He was more than just a funny guy. He had a name, after all. But that was not even a fraction of the problems he was about to face. He had no idea that his laughter-filled career would soon take a dark turn and change Hollywood forever. On Labor Day, September 5th, 1921, Arbuckle decided to take a break from his busy film schedule and headed to San Francisco with his friends Lowell Sherman and Fred Fishback. They checked into 3 rooms at the San Francis Hotel, 1219 for Arbuckle and Fishback, 1221 for Sherman, and 1220 they designated the party room, all on the top floor. It was a pretty fancy European-style hotel with its own orchestra and Turkish baths. Now, even though it was 20 months into Prohibition, getting booze wasn't tough, especially for a star like Arbuckle. So that night, a shipment of gin and scotch arrived from Gooby's Grill. On the morning of September 5th, a guy named Ira Fort Louis, a gown salesman, was leaving the nearby Palace Hotel to meet one of Arbuckle's friends. He spotted a group from Los Angeles in the palace lobby and asked a bellboy about a cheek young woman with dark hair. The bellboy said, "Virginia Rapp, the movie actress." Apparently, Arbuckle's crew knew Rapp and invited her for some afternoon drinks. Rapp showed up around noon, wearing a stylish jade skirt and blouse with a Panama hat. She had told her companions, Alfred Simnacher and Maud Delmont, that she'd be back in 20 minutes if the party was a dud. In room 1220, Arbuckle, in pajamas and a purple bathrobe, was with a crowd of friends and showgirls, dancing to Ain't We Got Fun. They ordered more booze from Gooby's, and so Rapp joined the party, had orange blossoms, and chatted with Arbuckle for a while. At some point, she tried to use the bathroom in room 1221, but Delmont was in there with Arbuckle's actor friend, Lowell Sherman. So she decided to use the bathroom in Arbuckle's room, 1219. And then, just before 3 o'clock, Arbuckle went in too and locked the door behind him. Now, what happened behind those closed doors was dissected by 3 juries, a scandal-hungry public, and a century of amateur detectives. In one version, Arbuckle threw Rapp onto the bed and accidentally crushed her under his weight. In another, he found her sick and took care of her. They were alone together for 10 minutes or an hour, depending on who you believe. Delmont got worried and kicked the door down, calling Rapp's name, but Arbuckle said he opened it on his own. There is no way to know who to trust. But either way, when the others got into room 1219, Rapp was barely conscious, tearing at her clothes in pain, complaining of a horrible stomach ache. Things were already looking like they had spiraled out of control. But the hotel manager tried to take charge. They put her in a cold bath and moved her to another room, where a hotel doctor said she had too much to drink and it was a case of intoxication. While the doctors took care of that, the party continued in room 1220, and no one in that room could even imagine what was about to go down. Rapp spent 3 days in the hotel room and was being given morphine for her pain before finally being moved to a hospital. At the hospital, Rapp's friend, Bambina Maud Delmont, claimed that Arbuckle had sexually assaulted the actress. It was a serious allegation altogether, but the doctor found no evidence of sexual assault. But other complications that she had led to her death on September 9th, 4 days after she went to that hotel room. The reason identified as the cause of death was peritonitis, caused by a ruptured bladder, aggravated by chronic urinary tract infections. Now her death made things difficult for Arbuckle, as the tabloids sensationalized the incident, accusing Arbuckle of causing her death. Arbuckle's career took a nosedive as he faced negative media coverage in a public scandal. Rapp's companion, Maud Delmont, spread allegations of sexual assault, and Arbuckle found himself charged with causing Rapp's death. The tabloids only exploited the situation, fabricating details for sensational headlines. Arbuckle's trial was obviously a huge deal, and the media played a big part in it. Newspapers, driven by sensationalism, painted Arbuckle as a creepy guy who used his position to overpower innocent girls. William Randolph Hearst's newspaper chain took advantage of the situation with exaggerated stories, and he was pretty happy about the profits he made, reportedly saying it sold more papers than when the Lusitania sank. People from morality groups even called for Arbuckle to get the death penalty, so he was already losing his case in the public's mind. The first trial started on November 14th, 1921, in San Francisco. Arbuckle got Gavin McNabb, a local lawyer, as his lead defense counsel. With respect to his family, at the start of the trial, Arbuckle told his estranged wife, Minta Durfee, that he didn't hurt Rapp. Durfee believed him and showed up regularly to support him. But that didn't exactly work in her favor. Shots were fired at her as she entered the court because the public was considering Arbuckle guilty, thanks to the media's exaggerated reports. As we delve into the corridors of history, let's not forget our faithful companions, whose health is paramount. Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says that she is seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health, their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also supports the Jason Dubas Heigl Foundation, which also helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. My own journey with Badlands Pets has been enlightening. Seeing my dog thrive on Superfood Complete fills me with joy, knowing that I'm providing him with the best nutrition possible. Go to badlandsranch.com/hometown and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular priced order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/hometown today. Now, the prosecution's witnesses included model Betty Campbell, who said that Arbuckle seemed happy hours after the alleged sexual assault, and nurse Grace Holston, who thought Arbuckle was definitely guilty. Besides that, criminologist Dr. Howard Heinrich said fingerprints on the door proved Rapp tried to run away and that Arbuckle stopped her. But not everything was against Arbuckle, and the defense pointed that out. During cross-examination, Campbell later revealed she was threatened to testify by the prosecution, which obviously put a question mark on her statement. Even Heinrich's fingerprint claim was challenged when a hotel maid testified that the room was cleaned before the investigation. Even in his cross-examination with the hospital nurse about the medical reports, he was able to get her to agree to cancer as the reason for the ruptured bladder and the possibility that Rapp's heavy jewelry caused the bruises. Even Dr. Arthur Beardsley agreed that Rapp did not mention any assault or attack during the 3 days she was at the hotel under his care. Finally, 14 days after the trial started, Arbuckle got to share his version of events on the stand. According to him, he had known Rapp for about 5 to 6 years. He said she joined the party in room 1220 around noon. Later, Arbuckle went to his room, which was room 1219, to change clothes because Maytob needed a ride to town. When he got to his room, he found Rapp in the bathroom, vomiting. He claimed that Rapp said she felt sick and asked to lie down. He carried her to the bedroom and asked for help from other party guests. But when the others returned to the room, Rapp was on the floor, tearing at her clothes and having violent convulsions. To soothe her, they put her in a cool bath. Arbuckle and Fishback then moved her to room 1227 and called the hotel manager and doctor. Everyone thought Rapp was just very drunk at that point, including the hotel doctors, believing she would get better if she just slept. Arbuckle drove Taub into town as he originally planned to. After all the testimonies and Arbuckle's statement, the jury came back deadlocked on December 4, 1921, with a 10-2 not guilty verdict, leading to a mistrial. Now, what Arbuckle's defense focused on was juror Helen Hubbard, who seemed to have a strong bias against him. Some jurors revealed they believed Arbuckle was guilty, but not beyond a reasonable doubt. The defense claimed Hubbard was a villain, partly due to the media's attention on women serving on juries. So Arbuckle was released on bail after nearly 3 weeks in jail, and another trial would follow. The second trial started on January 11, 1922, with a new jury, with the same legal teams and judge. The same evidence was presented, but this time, another witness, Zay Previn, claimed that the prosecution forced her to lie during the first trial. This was the second time a witness had claimed that, and it was now being speculated that the prosecutor, Matthew Brady, was fueling the scandal for his political ambitions. And this did hurt his case. But things were not all in Arbuckle's favor this time, as well. Another witness from the first trial, Jesse Norgard, said Arbuckle once tried to bribe him for the key to Rapp's dressing room. But the thing was that Norgard was an ex-convict under the indictment for assaulting a child, so the credibility was naturally questioned. Nonetheless, the trial continued. But again, the jury was deadlocked on February 3rd with a 10-2 majority, leading to another mistrial. But this time the majority was in favor of conviction, an indication that things were now going against Arbuckle. A third trial would now follow, but obviously the media sensationalization was going on simultaneously with the trials. By the time of Arbuckle's third trial, on March 13, 1922, his films were banned and the media was filled with stories of Hollywood scandals. McNabb, Arbuckle's lawyer, took a strong stance, attacking the prosecution's case. This time, Previn was out of the country, which ended up weakening the prosecution. So after 6 minutes of deliberation, on October 12th, the jury finally returned a unanimous not guilty verdict, offering a formal apology to Arbuckle for the whole ordeal. The jury's statement expressed that they believed Arbuckle was entirely innocent and free from all blame. Some experts later thought that Rapp's bladder might have ruptured during an earlier abortion procedure, but her organs were too damaged for any confirmation at that point. Things ended up in favor of him, but he did plead guilty to violating the Volstead Act for alcohol consumption at the party and paid a $500 fine. With that, Arbuckle technically paid for his wrongdoing, but things were far from over. Despite his acquittal, Arbuckle faced financial struggles, owing over $700,000 in legal fees, forcing him to sell his house and cars. Even his return to Hollywood faced obstacles, and he struggled to reclaim his former glory. Although officially he was cleared of the murder charge, and the jury even apologized to him formally, the scandal continued to haunt him. It was undoubtedly unfair to a person who was found not guilty to have to deal with the consequences of the media's attempt at earning profits. But that was what he had to face, and both his personal and professional life were affected. He found limited opportunities to make the art he wanted, and eventually started directing short films under the alias William Goodrich. In 1932, Warner Brothers offered him a chance to star in comedy shorts, marking his return to the screen under his own name. But his comeback was unfortunately short-lived. In 1933, a decade after the scandal, Arbuckle suffered a fatal heart attack at the age of 46, ending a chaotic chapter in Hollywood history. But the influence of the scandal did not end at Arbuckle. Here comes the topic we started with, the influence on Hollywood itself. Hollywood executives, led by the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America, or MPA, were concerned about the industry's tarnished image after the whole Arbuckle situation. Will Hayes, the head of the MPA, wanted to rehabilitate Hollywood's reputation, which is why he introduced measures to regulate content, leading to the later adoption of the Motion Picture Production Code. These measures were a form of self-censorship by the industry to avoid external intervention or government-imposed censorship. The production code set clear rules for what could be shown in movies, especially when it came to sensitive topics like sex and crime. It said no to nudity, suggestive dances, and making fun of religion. Illegal drug use, venereal disease, rape, childbirth, and mixed race relationships were also off limits. In addition to that, the language rules banned several offensive words. Criminals couldn't be portrayed in a way that made viewers sympathize with them. Murder scenes had to be careful not to encourage imitation, and brutal killings couldn't be shown in too much detail. And movies had to uphold the importance of marriage and family life, even if adultery and illicit sex were part of the plot. They couldn't be too explicit or justified, and they shouldn't be portrayed as attractive choices. Basically, nobody, not the government or the people or the media, should ever get a chance to villainize Hollywood again. This code would continue to influence the content of Hollywood films for several decades, representing a form of internal censorship within the film industry. And that's a wrap on today's episode. This scandal reminds us of the power of public perception and the lasting effects it can have on an industry. Thank you for listening to Hometown History. And be sure to follow along for more interesting stories from the past.
Save big money on new windows now at Menards. Update your home with vinyl windows from Geldwin. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on Geldwin windows in store or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more window deals happening this week now at Menards. Save big.